Chapter 15. Exposition of the Internal Contradictions of the Law. Section 1. General. We have seen in the first part of this volume that the rate of profit expresses the rate of surplus value always lower than it actually is. We have just seen that even a rising rate of surplus value has a tendency to express itself in a falling rate of profit. The rate of profit would equal the rate of surplus value only if constant capital equals zero, that is, if the total capital were paid out in wages. A falling rate of profit does not express a falling rate of surplus value unless the proportion of the value of the constant capital to the quantity of labour power which sets it in motion remains unchanged, or the amount of labour power increases in relation to the value of the constant capital. On the plea of analysing the rate of profit, Ricardo actually analyses the rate of surplus value alone, and this only on the assumption that the working day is intensively and extensively a constant magnitude. A fall in the rate of profit and accelerated accumulation are different expressions of the same process only in so far as both reflect the development of productiveness. Accumulation, in turn, hastens the fall of the rate of profit, inasmuch as it implies a concentration of labour on a large scale, and thus a higher composition of capital. On the other hand, a fall in the rate of profit again hastens the concentration of capital and its centralisation through expropriation of minor capitalists, the few direct producers who still have anything left to be expropriated. This accelerates accumulation with regard to mass, although the rate of accumulation falls with the rate of profit. On the other hand, the rate of self-expansion of the total capital, or the rate of profit being the goad of capitalist production, just as self-expansion of capital is its only purpose, its fall checks the formation of new independent capitals and thus appears as a threat to the development of the capitalist production process. It breeds overproduction, speculation, crises, and surplus capital alongside surplus population. Those economists, therefore, who, like Ricardo, regard the capitalist mode of production as absolute, feel at this point that it creates a barrier itself, and for this reason attribute the barrier to nature, in the theory of rent, not to production. But the main thing about their horror of the falling rate of profit is the feeling that capitalist production meets, in the development of its productive forces, a barrier which has nothing to do with the production of wealth as such, and this peculiar barrier testifies to the limitations and to the merely historical, transitory character of the capitalist mode of production, testifies that for the production of wealth, it is not an absolute mode, moreover, that at a certain stage it rather conflicts with its further development. True, Ricardo and his school considered only industrial profit, which includes interest. But the rate of ground rent likewise has a tendency to fall, although its absolute mass increases, and may also increase proportionately more than industrial profit. E. West, Essay on the Application of Capital to Land, London, 1815, who developed the law of ground rent before Ricardo. If we call the total social capital C, and use P1 for the industrial profit that remains after deducting interest and ground rent, I for interest and R for ground rent, then surplus value, S over C equals P over C equals P1 plus I plus R over C equals P1 over C plus I over C plus R over C. We have seen that while S, the total amount of surplus value, is continually increasing in the course of capitalist development, S over C is just as steadily declining, because C grows still more rapidly than S. Therefore, it is by no means a contradiction for P1, I, and R to be steadily increasing, each individually, while S over C equals P over C, as well as P1 over C, I over C, and R over C, should each by itself be steadily shrinking, or that P1 should increase in relation to I, or R in relation to P1, or to P1 and I. With a rising total surplus value or profit S equals P, and a simultaneously falling rate of profit S over C equals P over C, the proportions of the parts P1, I, and R, which make up S equals P, may change at will within the limits set by the total amount of S, without thereby affecting the magnitude of S or S over C. The mutual variation of P1, I, and R is merely a varying distribution of S among different classes. Consequently, P1 over C, I over C, or R over C, the rate of individual industrial profit, the rate of interest, and the ratio of ground rent to the total capital, may rise in relation to one another, while S over C, the general rate of profit, falls. The only condition is that the sum of all three equals S over C. If the rate of profit falls from 50% to 25%, because the composition of a certain capital with, say, a rate of surplus value equal to 100% has changed from 50C plus 50V to 75C plus 25V, then a capital of 1,000 will yield a profit of 500 in the first case, and in the second, a capital of 4,000 will yield a profit of 1,000. We see that S or P have doubled, while P prime has fallen by one half. And if that 50% was formally divided into 20 profit, 10 interest, and 20 rent, then P1 over C equals 20%, I over C equals 10%, and R over C equals 20%. If the proportions had remained the same after the change from 50% to 25%, then P1 over C equals 10%, I over C equals 5%, and R over C equals 10%. If, however, P1 over C should fall to 8% and I over C to 4%, then R over C would rise to 13%. The relative magnitude of R would have risen as against P1 and I, while P would have remained the same. Under both assumptions, the sum of P1, I, and R would have increased, because produced by a capital four times as large. Furthermore, Ricardo's assumption that originally industrial profit plus interest contains the entire surplus value is historically and logically false. It is rather the progress of capitalist production which, 1, gives the whole profit directly to the industrial and commercial capitalists for further distribution, and 2, reduces rent to the excess over the profit. On this capitalist basis again, the rent grows, being a portion of profit, that is, of the surplus value viewed as the product of the total capital, but not that specific portion of the product which the capitalist pockets. Given the necessary means of production, that is, a sufficient accumulation of capital, the creation of surplus value is only limited by the laboring population if the rate of surplus value, that is, the intensity of exploitation, is given, and no other limit but the intensity of exploitation if the laboring population is given. And the capitalist process of production consists essentially of the production of surplus value, represented in the surplus product, or that aliquot portion of the produced commodities materializing unpaid labor. It must never be forgotten that the production of this surplus value, and the reconversion of a portion of it into capital or the accumulation forms an integral part of this production of surplus value, is the immediate purpose and compelling motive of capitalist production. It will never do, therefore, to represent capitalist production as something which it is not, namely as production whose immediate purpose is enjoyment, or the manufacture of the means of enjoyment for the capitalist. This would be overlooking its specific character, which is revealed in all its inner essence. The creation of this surplus value makes up the direct process of production, which, as we have said, has no other limits but those mentioned above. As soon as all the surplus labour it was possible to squeeze out has been embodied in commodities, surplus value has been produced. But this production of surplus value completes but the first act of the capitalist process of production, the direct production process. Capital has absorbed so and so much unpaid labour. With the development of the process, which expresses itself in a drop in the rate of profit, the mass of surplus value thus produced swells to immense dimensions. Now comes the second act of the process. The entire mass of commodities, that is, the total product, including the portion which replaces the constant and variable capital and that representing surplus value, must be sold. If this is not done, or done only in part, or only at prices below the prices of production, the labourer has been indeed exploited. But his exploitation is not realised as such for the capitalist. And this can be bound up with a total or partial failure to realise the surplus value pressed out of him, indeed, even with the partial or total loss of the capital. The conditions of direct exploitation and those of realising it are not identical. They diverge, not only in place and time, but also logically. The first are only limited by the productive power of society, the latter by the proportional relation of the various branches of production, and the consumer power of society. But this last named is not determined either by the absolute productive power or by the absolute consumer power, but by the consumer power based on antagonistic conditions of distribution, which reduce the consumption of the bulk of society to a minimum varying within more or less narrow limits. It is furthermore restricted by the tendency to accumulate, the drive to expand capital and produce surplus value on an extended scale. This is law for capitalist production, imposed by incessant revolutions in the methods of production themselves, by the depreciation of existing capital always bound up with them, by the general competitive struggle and the need to improve production and expand its scale merely as a means of self-preservation and under penalty of ruin. The market must, therefore, be continually extended, so that its interrelations and the conditions regulating them assume more and more the form of a natural law working independently of the producer and become ever more uncontrollable. This internal contradiction seeks to resolve itself through expansion of the outlying field of production, but the more productiveness develops, the more it finds itself at variance with the narrow basis on which the conditions of consumption rest. It is no contradiction at all on this self-contradictory basis that there should be an excess of capital simultaneously with a growing surplus of population. For while a combination of these two would indeed increase the mass of produced surplus value, it would at the same time intensify the contradiction between the conditions under which this surplus value is produced and those under which it is realized. If a certain rate of profit is given, the mass of profit will always depend on the magnitude of the advanced capital. The accumulation, however, is then determined by that portion of this mass which is reconverted into capital. As for this portion, being equal to the profit minus the revenue consumed by the capitalists, it will depend not merely on the value of this mass, but also on the cheapness of the commodities which the capitalist can buy with it, commodities which pass partly into his consumption, his revenue, and partly into his constant capital. Wages are here assumed to be given. The mass of capital set in motion by the labourer, whose value he preserves by his labour and reproduces in his product, is quite different from the value that he adds to it. If the mass of the capital equals 1,000, and the added labour equals 100, the reproduced capital equals 1,100. If the mass equals 100 and the added labour equals 20, the reproduced capital equals 120. In the first case, the rate of profit equals 10%. In the second, it equals 20%. And yet more can be accumulated out of 100 than out of 20. And thus the river of capital rolls on, aside from its depreciation through increase of the productiveness, or its accumulation does, not in proportion to the rate of profit, but in proportion to the impetus it already possesses. So far as it is based on a high rate of surplus value, a high rate of profit is possible when the working day is very long, although labour is not highly productive. It is possible because the wants of the labourers are very small, hence average wages very low, although the labour itself is unproductive. The low wages will correspond to the labourer's lack of energy. Capital then accumulates slowly, in spite of the high rate of profit. Population is stagnant, and the working time which the product costs is great, while the wages paid to the labourer are small. The rate of profit does not sink because the labourer is exploited any less, but because generally less labour is employed in proportion to the employed capital. If, as shown, a falling rate of profit is bound up with an increase in the mass of profit, a larger portion of the annual product of labour is appropriated by the capitalist under the category of capital, as a replacement for consumed capital, and a relatively smaller portion under the category of profit. Hence the fantastic idea of priest Chalmers. Thomas Chalmers, on Political Economy in Connection with the Moral State and Moral Prospects of Society, 2nd edition, Glasgow, 1832. That the less of the annual product is expended by capitalists as capital, the greater the profits they pocket. In which case, the state church comes to their assistance, to care for the consumption of the greater part of the surplus product, rather than having it used as capital. The preacher confounds cause with effect. Furthermore, the mass of profit increases, in spite of its slower rate, with the growth of the invested capital. However, this requires a simultaneous concentration of capital, since the conditions of production then demand employment of capital on a larger scale. It also requires its centralization, that is, the swallowing up of the small capitalists by the big, and their deprivation of capital. It is again but an instance of separating, raised to the second power, the conditions of production from the producers to whose number these small capitalists still belong, since their own labour continues to play a role in their case. The labour of a capitalist stands altogether in inverse proportion to the size of his capital, that is, to the degree in which he is a capitalist. It is this same severance of the conditions of production on the one hand, from the producers on the other, that forms the conception of capital. It begins with primitive accumulation. Capital, Volume 1, Part 8. Appears as a permanent process in the accumulation and concentration of capital, and expresses itself finally as centralization of existing capitals in a few hands, and a deprivation of many of their capital. This process would soon bring about the collapse of capitalist production if it were not for counteracting tendencies, which have a continuous decentralizing effect alongside the centripetal one. Section 2. Conflict between expansion of production and production of surplus value. The development of the social productiveness of labor is manifested in two ways. First, in the magnitude of the already produced productive forces, the value and mass of the conditions of production under which new production is carried on, and in the absolute magnitude of the already accumulated productive capital. Secondly, in the relative smallness of the portion of total capital laid out in wages, that is, in the relatively small quantity of living labor required for the reproduction and self-expansion of a given capital for mass production. This also implies concentration of capital. In relation to employed labor power, the development of the productivity again reveals itself in two ways. First, in the increase of surplus labor, that is, the reduction of the necessary labor time required for the reproduction of labor power. Secondly, in the decrease of the quantity of labor power, the number of laborers generally employed to set in motion a given capital. The two movements not only go hand in hand, but mutually influence one another and are phenomena in which the same law expresses itself. Yet, they affect the rate of profit in opposite ways. The total mass of profit is equal to the total mass of surplus value. The rate of profit equals surplus value over the advanced total capital. The surplus value, however, as a total, is determined first by its rate, and second by the mass of labor simultaneously employed at this rate, or, what amounts to the same, by the magnitude of the variable capital. One of these factors, the rate of surplus value, rises, and the other, the number of laborers, falls, relatively or absolutely. Inasmuch as the development of the productive forces reduces the paid portion of employed labor, it raises the surplus value because it raises its rate. But inasmuch as it reduces the total mass of labor employed by a given capital, it reduces the factor of the number by which the rate of surplus value is multiplied to obtain its mass. Two laborers, each working 12 hours daily, cannot produce the same mass of surplus value as 24 who work only 2 hours, even if they could live on air, and hence did not have to work for themselves at all. In this respect, then, the compensation of the reduced number of laborers by intensifying the degree of exploitation has certain insurmountable limits. It may for this reason well check the fall in the rate of profit, but cannot prevent it altogether. With the development of the capitalist mode of production, therefore, the rate of profit falls, while its mass increases with the growing mass of the capital employed. Given the rate, the absolute increase in the mass of capital depends on its existing magnitude. But on the other hand, if this magnitude is given, the proportion of its growth, that is, the rate of its increment, depends on the rate of profit. The increase in the productiveness, which, moreover, we repeat, always goes hand in hand with a depreciation of the available capital, can directly only increase the value of the existing capital if, by raising the rate of profit, it increases that portion of the value of the annual product which is reconverted into capital. As concerns the productivity of labor, this can only occur, since this productivity has nothing direct to do with the value of the existing capital, by raising the relative surplus value, or reducing the value of the constant capital, so that the commodities which enter either the reproduction of labour power or the elements of constant capital are cheapened. Both imply a depreciation of the existing capital, and both go hand in hand with a reduction of the variable capital in relation to the constant. Both cause a fall in the rate of profit, and both slow it down. Furthermore, inasmuch as an increased rate of profit causes a greater demand for labour, it tends to increase the working population, and thus the material whose exploitation makes real capital out of capital. Indirectly, however, the development of the productivity of labour contributes to the increase of the value of the existing capital by increasing the mass and variety of use values, in which the same exchange value is represented and which form the material substance, that is, the material elements of capital, the material objects making up the constant capital directly, and the variable capital at least indirectly. More products, which may be converted into capital, whatever their exchange value, are created with the same capital and the same labour. These products may serve to absorb additional labour, hence also additional surplus labour, and therefore create additional capital. The amount of labour which a capital can command does not depend on its value, but on the mass of raw and auxiliary materials, machinery, and elements of fixed capital and necessities of life, all of which it comprises, whatever their value may be. As the mass of labour employed, and thus of surplus labour, increases, there is also a growth in the value of the reproduced capital, and in the surplus value newly added to it. These two elements, embraced by the process of accumulation, however, are not to be regarded merely as existing side by side in repose, as Ricardo does. They contain a contradiction which manifests itself in contradictory tendencies and phenomena. These antagonistic agencies counteract each other simultaneously. Alongside the stimulants of an actual increase of the labouring population, which spring from the increase of the portion of the total social product serving as capital, there are agencies which create a merely relative overpopulation. Alongside the fall in the rate of profit, mass of capitals grows, and hand in hand with this there occurs a depreciation of existing capitals, which checks the fall and gives an accelerating motion to the accumulation of capital values. Alongside the development of productivity, there develops a higher composition of capital, that is, the relative decrease of the ratio of variable to constant capital. These different influences may at one time operate predominantly side by side in space, and at another succeed each other in time. From time to time, the conflict of antagonistic agencies finds vent in crises. The crises are always but momentary and forcible solutions of the existing contradictions. They are violent eruptions which for a time restore the disturbed equilibrium. The contradiction, to put it in a very general way, consists in that the capitalist mode of production involves a tendency towards absolute development of the productive forces, regardless of the value and surplus value it contains, and regardless of the social conditions under which capitalist production takes place. While on the other hand, its aim is to preserve the value of the existing capital and promote its self-expansion to the highest limit, that is, to promote an ever more rapid growth of this value. The specific feature about it is that it uses the existing value of capital as a means of increasing this value to the utmost. The methods by which it accomplishes this include the fall of the rate of profit, depreciation of existing capital, and development of the productive forces of labour at the expense of already created productive forces. The periodical depreciation of existing capital, one of the means inherent in capitalist production to check the fall of the rate of profit and hasten accumulation of capital value through formation of new capital, disturbs the given conditions within which the process of circulation and reproduction of capital takes place, and is therefore accompanied by sudden stoppages and crises in the production process. The decrease of variable in relation to constant capital, which goes hand in hand with the development of the productive forces, stimulates the growth of the labouring population while continually creating an artificial overpopulation. The accumulation of capital, in terms of value, is slowed down by the falling rate of profit, to hasten still more the accumulation of use values, while this, in its turn, adds new momentum to accumulation in terms of value. Capitalist production seeks continually to overcome these inherent barriers, but overcomes them only by means which again place these barriers in its way, and on a more formidable scale. The real barrier of capitalist production is capital itself. It is that capital and its self-expansion appear as the starting and the closing point, the motive and the purpose of production. That production is only production for capital, and not vice versa. The means of production are not mere means for a constant expansion of the living process of the society of producers. The limits within which the preservation and self-expansion of the value of capital resting on the expropriation and pauperization of the great mass of producers can alone move, these limits come continually into conflict with the methods of production employed by capital for its purposes, which drive towards unlimited extension of production, towards production as an end in itself, towards unconditional development of the social productivity of labour. The means, unconditional development of the productive forces of society, comes continually into conflict with the limited purpose, the self-expansion of the existing capital. The capitalist mode of production is, for this reason, a historical means of developing the material forces of production and creating an appropriate world market, and is, at the same time, a continual conflict between this, its historical task, and its own corresponding relations of social production. Section 3. Excess Capital and Excess Population. A drop in the rate of profit is attended by a rise in the minimum capital required by an individual capitalist for the productive employment of labour, required both for its exploitation generally and for making the consumed labour time suffice as the labour time necessary for the production of the commodities, so that it does not exceed the average social labour time required for the production of the commodities. Concentration increases simultaneously, because beyond certain limits, a large capital with a small rate of profit accumulates faster than a small capital with a large rate of profit. At a certain high point, this increasing concentration, in its turn, causes a new fall in the rate of profit. The mass of small dispersed capitals is thereby driven along the adventurous road of speculation, credit frauds, stock swindles, and crises. The so-called plethora of capital always applies essentially to a plethora of the capital for which the fall in the rate of profit is not compensated through the mass of profit. This is always true of newly developing fresh offshoots of capital, or to a plethora which places capitals incapable of action on their own at the disposal of the managers of large enterprises in the form of credit. This plethora of capital arises from the same causes as those which call forth relative overpopulation, and is, therefore, a phenomenon supplementing the latter, although they stand at opposite poles, unemployed capital at one pole and unemployed worker population at the other. Overproduction of capital, not of individual commodities, although overproduction of capital always includes overproduction of commodities, is therefore simply overaccumulation of capital. To appreciate what this overaccumulation is, its closer analysis follows later, one need only assume it to be absolute. When would overproduction of capital be absolute? Overproduction which would affect not just one or another, or a few important spheres of production, but would be absolute in its full scope, hence would extend to all fields of production? There would be absolute overproduction of capital as soon as additional capital for purposes of capitalist production equals zero. The purpose of capitalist production, however, is self-expansion of capital, that is, appropriation of surplus labour, production of surplus value, of profit. As soon as capital would, therefore, have grown in such a ratio to the labouring population that neither the absolute working time supplied by this population nor the relative surplus working time could be expanded any further. This last would not be feasible, at any rate, in the case when the demand for labour were so strong that there were a tendency for wages to rise. At a point, therefore, when the increased capital produced only as much or even less surplus value than it did before its increase, there would be absolute overproduction of capital, that is, the increased capital C plus delta capital C would produce no more or even less profit than capital C before its expansion by delta capital C. In both cases, there would be a steep and sudden fall in the general rate of profit, but this time due to a change in the composition of capital, not caused by the development of the productive forces, but rather by a rise in the money value of the variable capital because of increased wages and the corresponding reduction in the proportion of surplus labour to necessary labour. In reality, it would appear that a portion of the capital would lie completely or partially idle because it would have to crowd out some of the active capital before it could expand its own value, and the other portion would produce values at a lower rate of profit, owing to the pressure of unemployed or partly employed capital. It would be immaterial in this respect if a part of the additional capital were to take the place of the old capital, and the latter were to take its position in the additional capital. We should still always have the old sum of capital on one side, and the sum of additional capital on the other. The fall in the rate of profit would then be accompanied by an absolute decrease in the mass of profit, since the mass of employed labour power could not be increased, and the rate of surplus value raised under the conditions we had assumed, so that the mass of surplus value could not be increased either. And the reduced mass of profit would have to be calculated on an increased total capital. But even if it is assumed that the employed capital continues to self-expand at the old rate of profit, and the mass of profit hence remains the same, this mass would still be calculated on an increased total capital, this likewise implying a fall in the rate of profit. If a total capital of 1,000 yielded a profit of 100, and after being increased to 1,500 still yielded 100, then, in the second case, 1,000 would yield only 66 2/3. Self-expansion of the old capital, in the absolute sense, would have been reduced. The capital of 1,000 would yield no more under the new circumstances than formerly a capital of 66 2/3 did. It is evident, however, that this actual depreciation of the old capital could not occur without a struggle, and that the additional delta capital C could not assume the functions of capital without a struggle. The rate of profit would not fall under the effect of competition caused by overproduction of capital. It would rather be the reverse. It would be the competitive struggle which would begin because the fallen rate of profit and overproduction of capital originate from the same conditions. The part of delta capital C in the hands of old functioning capitalists would be allowed to remain more or less idle to prevent a depreciation of their own original capital and not to narrow its place in the field of production. Or they would employ it, even at a momentary loss, to shift the need of keeping additional capital idle onto newcomers and onto their competitors in general. That portion of delta capital C, which is in new hands, would seek to assume a place for itself at the expense of the old capital, and would accomplish this, in part, by forcing a portion of the old capital to lie idle. It would compel the old capital to give up its old place and withdraw, to join completely or partially unemployed additional capital. A portion of the old capital has to lie unused under all circumstances. It has to give up its characteristic quality as capital, so far as acting as such and producing value is concerned. The competitive struggle would decide what part of it would be particularly affected. So long as things go well, competition effects an operating fraternity of the capitalist class, as we have seen in the case of the equalization of the general rate of profit, so that each shares in the common loot in proportion to the size of his respective investment. But as soon as it no longer is a question of sharing profits, but of sharing losses, everyone tries to reduce his own share to a minimum and to shove it off upon another. The class, as such, must inevitably lose. How much the individual capitalist must bear of the loss, that is, to what extent he must share in it at all, is decided by strength and cunning, and competition then becomes a fight among hostile brothers. The antagonism between each individual capitalist's interest and those of the capitalist class as a whole then comes to the surface, just as previously the identity of these interests operated in practice through competition. How is this conflict settled, and the conditions restored which correspond to the sound operation of capitalist production? The mode of settlement is already indicated in the very emergence of the conflict whose settlement is under discussion. It implies the withdrawal and even the partial destruction of capital, amounting to the full value of additional delta capital C, or at least part of it. Although, as the description of this conflict shows, the loss is by no means equally distributed among individual capitals, its distribution being rather decided through a competitive struggle in which the loss is distributed in very different proportions and forms, depending on special advantages or previously captured positions, so that one capital is left unused, another is destroyed, and a third suffers but a relative loss, or is just temporarily depreciated, etc. But the equilibrium would be restored under all circumstances through the withdrawal or even the destruction of more or less capital. This would extend partly to the material substance of capital, that is, a part of the means of production of fixed and circulating capital would not operate, not act as capital. Some of the operating establishments would then be brought to a standstill. Although in this respect time attacks and worsens all means of production, except land, the stoppage would in reality cause far greater damage to the means of production. However, the main effect in this case would be that these means of production would cease to function as such, that their function as means of production would be disturbed for a shorter or longer period. The main damage, and that of the most acute nature, would occur in respect to capital, and insofar as the latter possesses the characteristic of value, it would occur in respect to the values of capitals. That portion of the value of a capital which exists only in the form of claims on prospective shares of surplus value, that is, profit, in fact, in the form of promissory notes on production in various forms, is immediately depreciated by the reduction of the receipts on which it is calculated. A part of the gold and silver lies unused, that is, does not function as capital. Part of the commodities on the market can complete their process of circulation and reproduction only through an immense contraction of their prices, hence through a depreciation of the capital which they represent. The elements of fixed capital are depreciated to a greater or lesser degree in just the same way. It must be added that definite, presupposed price relations govern the process of reproduction, so that the latter is halted and thrown into confusion by a general drop in prices. This confusion and stagnation paralyzes the function of money as a medium of payment, whose development is geared to the development of capital and is based on those presupposed price relations. The chain of payment obligations due at specific dates is broken in 100 places. The confusion is augmented by the attendant collapse of the credit system, which develops simultaneously with capital, and leads to violent and acute crises, to sudden and forcible depreciations, to the actual stagnation and disruption of the process of reproduction, and thus to a real falling off in reproduction. But there would have been still other agencies at work at the same time. The stagnation of production would have laid off a part of the working class, and would thereby have placed the employed part in a situation where it would have to submit to a reduction of wages even below the average. This has the very same effect on capital as an increase of the relative or absolute surplus value at average wages would have had. Prosperity would have led to more marriages among labourers, and reduced the decimation of offspring. While implying a real increase in population, this does not signify an increase in the actual working population, but it affects the relations of the labourer to capital in the same way as an increase of the number of actually working labourers would have affected them. On the other hand, the fall in prices and the competitive struggle would have driven every capitalist to lower the individual value of his total product below its general value by means of new machines, new and improved working methods, new combinations. That is, to increase the productivity of a given quantity of labour, to lower the proportion of variable to constant capital, and thereby to release some labourers. In short, to create an artificial overpopulation. Ultimately, the depreciation of the elements of constant capital would itself tend to raise the rate of profit. The mass of employed constant capital would have increased in relation to variable, but its value could have fallen. The ensuing stagnation of production would have prepared, within capitalistic limits, a subsequent expansion of production. And thus the cycle would run its course anew. Part of the capital, depreciated by its functional stagnation, would recover its old value. For the rest, the same vicious circle would be described once more under expanded conditions of production, with an expanded market and increased productive forces. However, even under the extreme conditions assumed by us, this absolute overproduction of capital is not absolute overproduction, not absolute overproduction of means of production. It is overproduction of means of production only in so far as the latter serve as capital, and consequently include a self-expansion of value, must produce an additional value in proportion to the increased mass. Yet it would still be overproduction, because capital would be unable to exploit labor to the degree required by a sound, normal development of the process of capitalist production, to a degree which would at least increase the mass of profit along with the growing mass of the employed capital, to a degree which would, therefore, prevent the rate of profit from falling as much as the capital grows, or even more rapidly. Overproduction of capital is never anything more than overproduction of means of production, of means of labor and necessities of life, which may serve as capital, that is, may serve to exploit labor at a given degree of exploitation. A fall in the intensity of exploitation below a certain point, however, calls forth disturbances and stoppages in the capitalist production process, crises and destruction of capital. It is no contradiction that this overproduction of capital is accompanied by more or less considerable relative overpopulation. The circumstances which increased the productiveness of labor augmented the mass of produced commodities, expanded markets, accelerated accumulation of capital, both in terms of its mass and its value, and lowered the rate of profit. These same circumstances have also created, and continuously create, a relative overpopulation, an overpopulation of laborers not employed by the surplus capital, owing to the low degree of exploitation at which alone they could be employed, or at least owing to the low rate of profit which they would yield at the given degree of exploitation. If capital is sent abroad, this is not done because it absolutely could not be applied at home, but because it can be employed at a higher rate of profit in a foreign country. But such capital is absolute excess capital for the employed labouring population and for the home country in general. It exists as such alongside the relative overpopulation, and this is an illustration of how both of them exist side by side and mutually influence one another. On the other hand, a fall in the rate of profit connected with accumulation necessarily calls forth a competitive struggle. Compensation of a fall in the rate of profit by a rise in the mass of profit applies only to the total social capital and to the big, firmly placed capitalists. The new additional capital operating independently does not enjoy any such compensating conditions. It must still win them. And so it is that a fall in the rate of profit calls forth a competitive struggle among capitalists, not vice versa. To be sure, the competitive struggle is accompanied by a temporary rise in wages and a resultant further temporary fall of the rate of profit. The same occurs when there is an overproduction of commodities, when markets are overstocked. Since the aim of capital is not to minister to certain wants but to produce profit, and since it accomplishes this purpose by methods which adapt the mass of production to the scale of production, not vice versa, a rift must continually ensue between the limited dimensions of consumption under capitalism and a production which forever tends to exceed this inherent barrier. Furthermore, capital consists of commodities, and therefore overproduction of capital implies overproduction of commodities. Hence, the peculiar phenomenon of economists who deny overproduction of commodities, admitting overproduction of capital. To say that there is no general overproduction, but rather a disproportion within the various branches of production, is no more than to say that under capitalist production, the proportionality of the individual branches of production springs as a continual process from disproportionality, because the cohesion of the aggregate production imposes itself as a blind law upon the agents of production, and not as a law which, being understood, and hence controlled, by their common mind, brings the productive process under their joint control. It amounts furthermore to demanding that countries in which capitalist production is not developed should consume and produce at a rate which suits the countries with capitalist production. If it is said that overproduction is only relative, this is quite correct. But the entire capitalist mode of production is only a relative one, whose barriers are not absolute. They are absolute only for this mode, that is, on its basis. How could there otherwise be a shortage of demand for the very commodities which the mass of the people lack? And how would it be possible for this demand to be sought abroad, in foreign markets, to pay the labourers at home the average amount of necessities of life? This is possible only because in this specific capitalist interrelation, the surplus product assumes a form in which its owner cannot offer it for consumption unless it first reconverts itself into capital for him. If it is finally said that the capitalists have only to exchange and consume their commodities among themselves, then the entire nature of the capitalist mode of production is lost sight of, and also forgotten is the fact that it is a matter of expanding the value of capital, not consuming it. In short, all these objections to the obvious phenomena of overproduction, phenomena which pay no heed to these objections, amount to the contention that the barriers of capitalist production are not barriers of production generally, and therefore not barriers of this specific capitalist mode of production. The contradiction of the capitalist mode of production, however, lies precisely in its tendency towards an absolute development of the productive forces, which continually come into conflict with the specific conditions of production in which capital moves, and alone can move. There are not too many necessities of life produced in proportion to the existing population. Quite the reverse. Too little is produced to decently and humanely satisfy the wants of the great mass. There are not too many means of production produced to employ the able-bodied portion of the population. Quite the reverse. In the first place, too large a portion of the produced population is not really capable of working, and is, through force of circumstances, made dependent on exploiting the labour of others, or on labour which can pass under this name only under a miserable mode of production. In the second place, not enough means of production are produced to permit the employment of the entire able-bodied population under the most productive conditions, so that their absolute working period could be shortened by the mass and effectiveness of the constant capital employed during working hours. On the other hand, too many means of labour and necessities of life are produced at times to permit of their serving as means for the exploitation of labourers at a certain rate of profit. Too many commodities are produced to permit of a realization and conversion into new capital of the value and surplus value contained in them under the conditions of distribution and consumption peculiar to capitalist production. That is, too many to permit of the consummation of this process without constantly recurring explosions. Not too much wealth is produced, but at times too much wealth is produced in its capitalistic, self-contradictory forms. The limitations of the capitalist mode of production come to the surface. Limitation 1. In that the development of the productivity of labour creates out of the falling rate of profit a law which, at a certain point, comes into antagonistic conflict with this development and must be overcome constantly through crises. Limitation 2. In that the expansion or contraction of production are determined by the appropriation of unpaid labour and the proportion of this unpaid labour to materialised labour in general, or, to speak the language of the capitalists, by profit and the proportion of this profit to the employed capital, thus by a definite rate of profit, rather than the relation of production to social requirements, that is, to the requirements of socially developed human beings. It is for this reason that the capitalist mode of production meets with barriers at a certain expanded stage of production, which, if viewed from the other premise, would reversely have been altogether inadequate. It comes to a standstill at a point fixed by the production and realization of profit, and not the satisfaction of requirements. If the rate of profit falls, there follows, on the one hand, an exertion of capital in order that the individual capitalists, through improved methods, etc., may depress the value of their individual commodity below the social average value, and thereby realize an extra profit at the prevailing market price. On the other hand, there appears swindling, and a general promotion of swindling, by recourse to frenzied ventures with new methods of production, new investments of capital, new adventures, all for the sake of securing a shred of extra profit, which is independent of the general average and rises above it. The rate of profit, that is, the relative increment of capital, is above all important to all new offshoots of capital seeking to find an independent place for themselves. And as soon as formation of capital were to fall into the hands of a few established big capitals, for which the mass of profit compensates for the falling rate of profit, the vital flame of production would be altogether extinguished. It would die out. The rate of profit is the motive power of capitalist production. Things are produced only so long as they can be produced with a profit. Hence the concern of the English economists over the decline of the rate of profit. The fact that the bare possibility of this happening should worry Ricardo shows his profound understanding of the conditions of capitalist production. It is that which is held against him. It is his unconcern about human beings, and his having an eye solely for the development of the productive forces, whatever the cost in human beings and capital values. It is precisely that which is the important thing about him. Development of the productive forces of social labour is the historical task and justification of capital. This is just the way in which it unconsciously creates the material requirements of a higher mode of production. What worries Ricardo is the fact that the rate of profit, the stimulating principle of capitalist production, the fundamental premise and driving force of accumulation, should be endangered by the development of production itself. And here the quantitative proportion means everything. There is, indeed, something deeper behind it, of which he is only vaguely aware. It comes to the surface here in a purely economic way, that is, from the bourgeois point of view within the limitations of capitalist understanding, from the standpoint of capitalist production itself, that it has its barrier, that it is relative, that it is not an absolute but only a historical mode of production corresponding to a definite limited epoch in the development of the material requirements of production.